Yeah. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Dennis Stitcher. How's everybody doing? I hope they got a good movie tonight. You may need it. Isn't this a fantastic place? I was really impressed coming in here today. I drove in and came through that gateway over there, and really when I got to the hotel here, I thought perhaps I was going to be greeted by Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck. I waited around for 5 minutes, and Goofy finally showed up, so that shows you what you're in for tonight. It's nice to come here and meet some old friends and hopefully to meet some new friends. A couple of the old friends that are going to be up here speaking, one of them is Wallace Bryant from North Carolina. If you get Wallace and talk to him any time at all, you're going to hear a lot of golf stories. He talks about golf all the time. I was talking to his sponsor one time, and I said, Tom, I said, that Wallace, I said, boy, he must really be a good golfer. He talks about it all the time. Tom said, no, he cheats. I said, what do you mean he cheats? He said, I played with him one time. He had a hole in one. He put a zero down on his card. Another good friend down here, Mark Bartolini. You'll hear him tomorrow. He's our southern representative from north. He's the only man I know when he goes to confession has to take his lunch with him. But my sobriety day is May 5th, 1981. And my home group is the Saturday Night Open Door Speakers Meeting in Tallahassee. It's one of the best two groups in the world. And my sponsor is Tommy Hicks from Crawfordville, Florida, and he's around here somewhere tonight. And I like to tell everybody that, you know, I'm all right until about 5 minutes before this starts, and I get real nervous. I was sharing that with Karen, and she said, well, I'm glad that still happens to everybody like you. I think probably this past year has been one of the best years of my life, and I had the opportunity to talk to Tom this afternoon, and we were sharing some things about sponsorship, and I think DeHolte and Mark's going to talk about that tomorrow, but we were talking about honesty and sponsorship, and from the sponsor to the sponsee, and we had a nice little talk back there. And then I was telling him, you know, one of the things I do every year, I read this book through from cover to cover, and I rework the steps. And this year, when I came to the fourth step, I really didn't have any resentments or fears or sexual conducts that I needed to address. And so I was kind of got a little, I said, well, what can I do about it? And so I said a little prayer, and it just came to me that I thought I'd go ahead and do an inventory about the people I appreciated and the people I loved. And, you know, I put those people down and made a list of them because, you know, I treated them pretty harshly in my original inventory. And I put down things of like my mother. I can remember that, I'm from Rizzi from West Virginia, and we have all four seasons up there. But I never left the house going to school in the morning. I didn't have a hot breakfast. Little things like that. You know, I can remember my dad taking off work to take me to a football game. Little things like that just mean an awful lot to me. And I guess I kind of reminisce a little bit. But that's the way I did a fourth step this year. And I just wanted to share that with you. I don't think there's anything else better than sitting around and talking to another alcoholic. And I've enjoyed my time. I got here about 1:30 today. And I've enjoyed talking to many of you. And I hope to talk to you, many of you, after tonight until through Sunday. But I want to thank the committee for inviting me to participate in this very nice event. And I'd like to thank Jack Daniels and Jim Beam for making it possible for me to be here. I was born during the Depression, and I had blue-collar parents, and I had a brother and a sister. And I want to put that up front because they had nothing to do with the way that I turned out. And matter of fact, I think my parents probably handed down to me the best way to possibly live that they knew how. And I took it and turned it around, and I made something crazy out of it. But I never took a drink when I was 3 years old, but I always felt like I could have used one. I waited until I was about 8 years old, and my father gave me my first drink. he liked to sit around on the front porch and drink beer with his friends. And right across the street, we had a beer garden, and he would send me as a gopher over to fill up a can with draft beer. And if I came back across the road and didn't drop any, then I got to take a sip of it. And you know, from the first time I sipped that, I felt like I belonged. I felt like I was a part of that group, and I liked that feeling that that beer gave me. And that relationship went on for another 43 years with alcohol. I used to go around and steal beer from the beer trucks. You know, they'd be on one side of the beer truck unloading and taking it into the beer garden. I'd be on the other side stuffing my pockets with beer. You know, I drank hot beer for about 9 years before everybody else drank it cold. I thought that foam was what you're supposed to sip on, you know. It's amazing what you do when you're a kid. My alcoholism probably started when I was about 12 years old. When I was in school and they'd have dances and everything, I'd always go stag. And I'd always stand in the corner with the stag boys, you know, and I always enjoyed that kind of life. I got an invitation one Christmas to go to a dance and had a girl's name on it. And I didn't understand what you're supposed to do about that. And finally, someone told me, well, you're supposed to call her up and that's the girl you're supposed to take to the dance. I said, okay. Well, my mother got me a corsage and I got my brother's hand-me-down clothes and put them on. And my dad drove me over and we picked her up. I gave her a corsage and walked her out to the car, got in the car, and they took me to the dance. And we went into the dance and she went into the girl's room to put her corsage on, and I took her coat over and hung it up, and I went over in the corner with the stag boys. I stayed over there for the majority of the evening. And I did that because that's all I ever did when I went to dances. When the evening came to an end, I noticed that she wasn't too happy with my behavior, and nor was anybody else. And I didn't get a very good saying of good night, you know, when I took her home. And when school started, I seemed like I was the black sheep. You know, everybody just treated me crazy, and somebody would laugh at me and everything else for what I did. And I never knew what that feeling was until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's that self-pity and incomprehensible demoralization, that feeling that you get, you know, that humiliation you got from all those people like that. You see, I didn't really understand what I was supposed to do. I didn't. And yet everybody else seemed to think like that I should have known what to do. And so I decided I was going to put on a facade. And this facade was who you're going to see. And you're going to have to be a pretty good person to get through this facade if you're going to be a friend of mine. And then I also got involved in sports. And I went to sports because that's where acceptance was. And that's where applause was. And that's where I didn't have to be humiliated anymore. And I played basketball, football, and ran track and pitched baseball. Anybody with a name like Diz has to pitch baseball, right? And I figured that. I went all through high school was the runner-up in the state basketball for the state of West Virginia. We had a decent football team. We was runner-ups in track. And so I was a pretty good athlete. And I got several scholarships. And the scholarship that I accepted was a local college right there in my hometown of Charleston, West Virginia, called Morse Harvey. And they gave me a basketball scholarship, so I accepted and went over there. And after there about 2 weeks, and we got acclimated to classes and everything, they had fraternity parties, and they started rushing people to join their fraternity. And I was rushed by two fraternities, and we had fraternity parties and everything else, and then it came time to choose the fraternity I wanted to. And so the fraternity I chose happened to be the one that was reprimanded for rowdy behavior and drunkenness 19 times by the president of the college. It seemed to fit. And I will say that the 4 years I was in that college, we was reprimanded 3 more times. I played basketball. I was very involved in college life, and I really enjoyed it. Now, this part of the story is going to date me, because my college was famous for a special day in November. On November 11th, we celebrated Sadie Hawkins Day. It was from the comic strip Little Abner, which was written by Al Capp. And we celebrated this, and Al Capp heard about it, and he wanted to come to our town and make a documentary. And so the president said, okay, and so Al Capp brings in all this film crew and everything else, and he gets all these people. We select Little Abner, we select Daisy Mae, Mammy and Pappy Yoakum, and Sadie Hawkins, who was the daughter of the mayor. Now, the purpose of this whole day was that all the single men had to line up on a starting line, and they were given a shotgun start, and they had to run. Well, 10 minutes later, all the single females lined up, and they started chasing the men. If they caught the men before sundown and got them back, they had to marry them. And so that's the way that Abner Hawkins thought he was going to get his daughter, Sadie, married off. Well, across from Dog Patch, there was a place called Skunk Holler. And Skunk Holler is where the Skag Boys was from. And the Skag Boys were notorious for making Kickapoo Joy Juice. And they drank all those things out of the jugs and everything. Boy, this lady, will you go to school with me? And so the school selected my fraternity to be the Skag Boys. And, of course, we grew the beards and long hair and wore the hats and had the guns and everything else. But what we did, we set up camp a little bit away from where all the activities were going to be handled. Over in our area over there, couldn't put a still up. So what we did, we got two wash tubs, we put ice in them and filled them up with grain alcohol. We put grape juice in one and lime juice in the other and stirred it up. We called one of them Purple Jesus and called the other one Green Goddammit. Now, if you went by and took two cups of either one of those things, you would start paying back things you never, ever borrowed. So let me tell you, by the end of the day, and everybody running from sundown, and, you know, and after that, they had the marriage ceremony between Daisy Mae and Little Abner, and Sadie Hawkins got her man, they got married, but then we had a square dance. Now, let me tell you what, there's nothing like the Skag Boys square dancing, you know, full of Kickapoo Joy Juice. I'm telling you, we were shooting off the rifles, we were do-si-doing and twisting our partner all around. Well, you can guess what, we got another letter of recommend the next time we went back to school for rowdy behavior and drunkenness. And so we lived up to our reputation once again. After college, I got drafted in the Army and went through orientation up in Maryland. And after I spent 2 weeks up there, they sent me to Fort Knox, Kentucky. That's 31 miles from Louisville. And I'm sure you've heard the reputation about Kentucky, right? Beautiful women, fast horses, and bourbon whiskey. Or is it beautiful horses, fast women, and bourbon whiskey? One of the two. Anyway, it seems like it fits. There was 9 distilleries around Louisville, Kentucky. And you know, on Saturday, they gave out free tours and samples. And you know, if you had a good day and a good car, you can make 4 of those distilleries and get free samples. Now, you know, normal drinkers don't do things like that, do they? That's what happened to me. But I was in the Army, and I liked to go to the PX and drink that beer. And also, I got to be a corporal, and I got to go to the NCO clubs. And you know, you could drink there for a quarter. And they didn't give you a little old shot of NCO club. They gave you a drink when you went in there for a quarter. So, you know, my drinking just kind of escalated a little bit, and again, I had that love affair with alcohol. I was managed to get through the Army okay, and I was discharged, and they came back home, and I went back to night school because there were some classes I wanted to take, and when I went back, I got involved in my fraternity again, and one of the big parades was coming up, and we had a float in the parade, and so we were decorating and everything, and two of the girls that was on the float, one of them was the ex-head majorette of the high school I went to. And I thought she was pretty attractive, so I asked her out for a date. And then, of course, you know, one thing led to another, and we got along pretty good, and we got married. And you know how that's going to be. The head majorette marries a big basketball star, and they're going to get this little white house with picket fence, and they're going to live happily ever after. Well, almost true. I had been developing those isms, and I settled in to go to work, and at 5 o'clock every night I was in a bar. Every night at 5 o'clock I was in a bar. Never came directly home any of those nights. We had three children that she raised pretty well. I was around probably on weekends when I wasn't running out to the beer joint to sneak a beer in real quick or somewhere like that. You know, we went to a lot of dances, and of course, I used to drink before I went to dances and drink when I was at the dances. We used to go card playing at different couples, and, you know, I'd always make sure I'd take my pint with me. You know, it seemed like that not only was I married to a lady, but my wife, I was also married to alcohol. It was just one of those things I just couldn't hardly put down. And it seemed like after that marriage got it going that my need for alcohol got greater and greater and greater. But normal drinkers don't drink like that. They just don't do like that. I got the manager of a discount store one time, and I spent 9.5 years with this company, and I ended up one of the top three stores in the chain. So a lot of traveling salesmen came through there, and because I was pretty good selling discount store, they'd always take you out. You know, they'd always invite you to go out for dinner. Well, you know, an alcoholic may go out to dinner, but if he does, he's going to have a few drinks. And it ended up in all my suppers I drank. You know, but it was always free. There's always somebody else was paying for it. And I got a lot of Christmas presents. And it seemed like every time I got a Christmas present, it was a bottle of some kind of bourbon, scotch, vodka. And so it just seemed like it just come easy for me. While I was manager of one of these stores, the general manager of the Ford place next door, he and I kind of took a liking to one another, and so he invited me to come down to his golf club and play golf with him one Thursday. And I said, fine. Well, I would drive my car because I had to get away home. It was about 24 and a half miles down the road. So I'd pick up Hack, that was his name, and we'd go down the road. He'd say, stop here. And he'd run in, he'd get a six-pack. And we'd come back out, and we'd drink that six-pack. And I'm driving. I only had two beers. He would drink four. And then we'd get to his place, and we'd put our golf shoes on and get dressed for that, and we'd get the golf cart. And we had these things called bazookas. They were big round cylinders, foam-covered, and you could put beers down in them, put a cap on them, and we'd put them on a golf cart, and walk around drive around the golf course and play golf and pop those beers. Well, a friend of ours lived on number 6, and he kind of had a little place there where he had some beer in a refrigerator. So we'd stop in here and get some more beer. Everywhere we went around the course was like that. We always knew somebody where we could do it. But when we got to number 14, this is where Red had his log cabin. And we'd drive through the bushes and park our golf carts and take our shoes off and go in Red's house. Now we got down to some serious drinking. That was at the 14th hole. And we would sit there and drink shooters. And shooters were either gin or vodka with some kind of juice in it. And we'd sit there and drink maybe 6, 7 till it got dark. And then we'd have to take those golf carts and drive them up the road because it was too dark to play any, you know, golf to get back in. And then we'd spend the night, and then I'd get up and go to work the next day and drive back in from Hack's house. Well, I wasn't a very good golfer, but one year I wanted to play in the club championship because they have different, different levels of golf that you play. And I figured, well, I can play at a certain level. You know, I can't play with the big boys. I could play with these guys up here. So I submitted my name and paid my entrance fee. I didn't hear anything about it until I went down that next Thursday to play golf with Red and Hack and Billy. And the pro yelled at me. He said, "Diaz, come here a minute." I said, "What?" And his name was George Belgian. I'll never forget. He said, "You signed up to play in this golf tournament." And he said, "We can't establish a handicap for you." And I said, "Well, George, why not? I said, I've been playing golf down here for a year." He said, "Yeah, Diaz, but you never played more than 14 holes." I took a couple of transfers. I transferred out of that job and left. You know, I took my disease with me, and I was on the road as a traveling salesman for a few years, selling some lawn and garden equipment and some building supplies and things like that. And I developed a pretty good clientele in the area I was covered in, West Virginia and some in Virginia. And I was on the road about 3.5 years, I think, and one of my clients told me one time, said, "Well, Diaz, don't you know that so-and-so company is looking for a salesman in this area?" And I said, "No." He said, "Yeah, you know, it's be a good job for you because you're only selling one product." And I said, "Well, yeah, that's real nice." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Send a resume in this company because I told him about you." And I said, "Well, okay." So I got a resume together and I sent it into this company. And the sales manager called me and said he was coming in town and he was going to interview about 12 of us that had sent resumes in. And so I went in for my interview with the sales manager, and after it I went back out and went back out on the road and then got a call about 3 days later, and the sales manager said, "Well, we selected you as one of the three finalists, and the vice president of the company is going to come in and interview three guys and to select the one to represent us in this area." I said, "Okay." Well, the next Monday, the secretary to the vice president calls me at my house and said, "Mr. Titcher, Mr. So-and-so is going to be coming in the airport at 1:30 in the afternoon on Friday, and would you pick him up and take him down to the hotel?" And I said, "Yes, I will." Seemed like I got this locked up right now, huh? And then my mind was just going, you know, alcoholics' mind, how they start working right now. I mean, I had that job already sewed up. If not, why'd they call me to pick up the vice president? You know, well, he must have checked on me and found out how good of a person. All these things started going, and I started just lickety-split. So I managed to get through the week, and of course, Friday came around, and I did a little bit of sales work, and finally, I looked at my watch and went up to the airport and went in and looked up on the board, and the plane was late. And it hadn't even left Pittsburgh yet. And it wouldn't be in till 6:30 that night. Oh, you already know what's going on. And so I said to myself, "Well, now what are you going to do? You got all this time, you got to wait." Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go down at my favorite bar and go in and talk to Gary. You know, because Gary and I can always talk. Well, now, you know, if you've got a favorite bar, when you hit that door, you've got a drink up on the table right there. And that's exactly what happened. Gary was there and had my drink up on the bar when I came in and sat down. Now, well, one won't hurt you. What's the book say? Once you take that first one, the phenomenal craving comes in, and you're off to the races. And that's exactly what happened. I sit there for about 4.5 hours talking to Gary, and I don't remember how many I had, but I did make it back to the airport. And I did meet that plane. I did pick up that vice president, and I put his luggage in my car. He got in my car, and I drove him down off the airport down to his motel. And I parked in front there, and I got out, and I got his luggage out and put it on the sidewalk. And he said, "Mr. Titcher, that's fine. Just drop my luggage right there." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Matter of fact, you don't even have to come back. I've seen about enough of you as I need to see." And the book tells us that, you know. That's what we do. That's what alcoholics do. We take a drink at the most inopportune moment, all because we think it's okay. That obsession will tear us up and tear us in two. So normal drinkers, again, don't do things like that. They simply don't do things like that. Well, I finally got divorced from that first wife. And those three kids turned out to be pretty good. And I was sashaying around and I was dating another girl. And I came in one day from work and I picked up my mail and I come into my apartment. And I just threw the mail down and it got me a drink and went over and said, well, I might as well look at the mail. And so I read the mail and my bank statement came in from the previous month. This was January. And I said, well, so I opened it up and I took it and I put the checks out and I got my checkbook out and I was starting to check them off. But I was checking them off, I put them in piles. Well, this is for living expenses, you know. This is food. This is drink. And I kept putting them up like that. After I checked them all off and went through the whole process, I looked over here, and this one over here was almost twice as big as any of the other ones. And I went through, and I added these up, the drinking bills. And I said, my God, I'm spending too much money drinking booze. I got to cut that out. I'm going to be bankrupt. I put all those checks away, picked up my car keys, and went to the whiskey store and bought 3 half-gallons of whiskey. Normal drinkers don't do things like that. But my drinking got pretty bad. And I knew something was wrong. And I said, well, I got a friend named McCoy. It's a psychologist. And I said, he and I went to school together. And he's awful nice. And so I called him up one day and I said, Mac, this is Diz. And I said, I haven't been feeling too good. And I wanted to know if I can come in and talk to you a while. Maybe you can help me out. And he said, fine, Diz. When do you want to come in? I said, well, I'm out on the road Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. How about sometime Thursday? He said, yeah, Thursday about 3:30 would be fine. So I got back in town. And I went into his office at 3:30 and he said, come in and sit down. He said, all right, tell me what's going on. And so I sat there for the next 2.5 hours and I told him my whole life story. I didn't pull any punches. I didn't sugarcoat anything at all. I called a spade a spade. And he just leaned back in his chair and he just kept shaking his head. And after I finished, he said, Diz, he said, I don't think I can do anything for you, but he said, there's a guy I want you to talk to. And I said, okay. He said, I'm going to make a call to him. It's too late now, but I'll call him tomorrow and see if I can't get you an appointment to see him. And I said, okay. And so I went home and probably went to a bar and drank some more before I went home. But anyway, next day, Mac did call me. He told me I had an appointment on Saturday morning at 9 o'clock at Dunn Hospital. Well, Dunn Hospital is where the psychos are. That's where the crazy people are. And I said, oh, that's what's the matter with me. I'm crazy. You know, it had to be something like that. And so I went down to Dunn Hospital, and this psychiatrist comes out, and he says, your name Diz? And I said, yes, it is. He said, come on in. And we went in and sit down in his office, and he said, well, tell me a little bit about yourself. And I said, okay. So I started telling him exactly what had been going in my life for about the last 5 or 6 years. And when I'd come up and tell him a certain story, he'd say, yeah, I know exactly how you feel. And I'd keep on talking, and he'd be shaking his head, yes. He said, yeah, I understand. I understand. And almost for the next 2.5 hours, this man would agree with almost everything, every single event that happened in my life. And after I got finished talking, he looked at me and he said, Diz, he said, I believe you're an alcoholic. And I think the best thing for you is for you to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, because they're the only kind of people that can help you. And I said, okay. That was better than the consequences of being put in the loony system, you know. So he gave me a list of meetings, and he had a couple of them circled there, and he said, The one on Tuesday night's very good. And he said, I think you ought to go to that one. I said, okay. Well, on Monday I went out of town to work, and of course, I was back in the bar at 5 o'clock, and then Tuesday I stayed out, and I didn't get home till about 9:30. And I walked in my apartment on Tuesday night, and I no sooner put my keys down and my suitcase, and the phone rang. And I answered the phone, and it was that psychiatrist. And I swear to God, I thought you all had police force. I thought you was out looking after me. And he said, you didn't go to that meeting tonight. And I said, no, and I started giving excuses. And he said, you don't have to make excuses for me. He said, you just didn't make the meeting. He said, now they got the same kind of meeting tomorrow night. I would like to have you there tomorrow night. And I said, okay. Well, I was going to work in my house anyway. I had some orders I had to post and get in and et cetera. So all day long, I never took a drink. And I was just shaking at the bit by the time that evening came when it's time to go to that meeting. And I went to that meeting. And I sat in about the third row, and I sat on the edge of my seat. It was a speaker's meeting. And I only could listen to this man for about the first 3.5 minutes, and then my head started wandering, and I was watching the fly over here go somewhere. And over here, I was watching something else. You know how our discipline is. I couldn't listen to anything for any period of time whatsoever. And the man finished up. And just before he finished up, I looked over across the room and I saw that psychiatrist sitting there. No wonder, he's an alcoholic too. So after the meeting was over, I walked over to him and he says, how you doing? And I said, not very good. He says, I know you're not. He said, I've been watching you. He said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to the grocery store and I want you to get a big jar of honey. And he said, instead of taking a drink when you get the urge, I want you to put a big tablespoon of honey in your mouth. It'll quiet you down. And I think that we can do something with you because I think you need to come to AA. I talked to this man that night again about Alcoholics Anonymous after the meeting. And he told me almost all his story. And it was like just a role reversal because I could agree with everything he was saying. And so, for the next 14 months, I went to AA meetings at least 3 or 4 times a week. I worked all those steps on the wall. And after 14 months, all I had was an off-the-wall program. I had a big book, but you know, it was sitting on my coffee table at home. And I wasn't making any progress at all. All I was a sober drunk. That's all. I wasn't getting any better. I still was a short fuse, ready to go off on you anytime you turned around. And so I went to a Monday night speakers meeting again, and after the meeting I was talking to a couple guys, and I got a tap on the shoulder. And I turned around and looked, and there was this old man standing there, and he said, is your name Diz? And I said, yes it is. He said, my name's Slick, and he said, I'm your new sponsor. I said, who said so? And he turned around, he pointed, he said, see those three guys over there? And I said, yeah. He said, well, we drew straws and I lost. I later found out those three guys over there, one had 38 years, the other had 33 years, and the third one had 29 years, and the guy talking to me had 22. And yet they took time out of their lives and came over and they wanted to do something for this old drunk. Well, I almost went off on this guy again. And I'm going to tell you this, something inside me told me not to. And I really believe at that time I had a spiritual experience. It was so small, but it was small enough to make me want to listen. And I think everybody in this room has had that spiritual experience. All we needed to make that work better is the education variety of the 12 steps to make it work good. But anyway, he said, I want you to come to my house every Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And I said, okay. He told me where he lived. And the first Sunday I came over. He said, bring your big book. And I said, okay. And as I got there about 2 o'clock, he met me at the front door. opened the screen door for me, and I came in. We went in the kitchen, and he had one of these white porcelain tables with these white wooden chairs. And over on the stove, he had an old coffee percolator perking on the stove. And I just said, wow, you know. And so I sat down at the table, and he got his cup of coffee, and he sat down at the table, and he said, open your big book up. Turn the first page. And I turned the first page. He said, what do you see? I said, nothing. There's nothing there. And he said, that's right. That's about all you know about Alcoholics Anonymous. And so he took me through this book spoonful at a time, page at a time, paragraph at a time. He explained things to me like, this is the basic textbook of all alcoholics. He explained to me that what we really have is a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And he explained these to me, you know. And he took his time. He's very patient with me. And we worked the steps out of the book. You know, when we got to the first step, which is on page 30, you know, it says, we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. That's nothing like it is up on the wall. Nothing. You know, when we talked about conceding, he told me that meant surrender. And he said, innermost. He said, where do you think your innermost self is? You got to be careful. When your sponsor asks you a question, you got to be careful how you answer. And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, if Bill Wilson, who's a co-writer, co-author of this book, wanted it to be your mind, I think he'd have put your mind in there. But he didn't put the mind in there. He said innermost. In the dictionary, there's no definition for innermost. Slick said, the innermost part of you is this area right here. And he said, this area is governed by your heart. And he said, I believe if you take accept this disease in your heart, I don't think you'll have any other trouble. And he said on a page 11 in this book, he said, there's a story about a man that coming to visit Bill Wilson. He was a schoolboy friend. His name was Evie Thacker. He was almost committed to an asylum for public drunkenness. But he got sober, and he came to see Bill Wilson. And he said, but my friend sat before me, and he made the point declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. But that's not the kicker. There's always a hook in this book. And the hook is down at the bottom of the page. Bill Wilson looks at Abby Thacker, who he knew was one of the biggest drunks he had ever run into, and he said, here is something at work in the human heart which had done the impossible. So that made more sense. Slick had proven to me that step one has to be taken in your heart, not your head. It's a lot like the boxer, being a boxer. And you know, you get up every morning, you put the gloves on, and you get in the ring and you fight your alcoholism. Well, you know, at the end of the day, when you get the finish, you come out of there, you're going to be black and blue and a couple of eyes black and cuts all over and everything else. And you're going to get all the bed rest you possibly can. The next morning, guess what you're going to do? You're going to get up and put the gloves on, and you're going to make it, you know, this time it'll be different. You're going to get in the ring, you're going to fight alcoholism again all day long and all night long. And you're going to come out there and you're going to be beaten up again. And you know, you go home, you get some rest, and the next morning you get up, and you put those gloves on, all of a sudden you walk into the ring, and there's a little boy out there. And the little boy looks at you and say, Mister, do you want to win? And you say, yeah, I'd like to win. He says, don't get in the ring. That's the first step. Lack of power, that was my dilemma. But we had to find a power which was greater than ourselves. But where are we going to find that power? Well, that's what this book is all about. It enables you to find a power which is greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. It won't help you. It will solve your problem. Bill writes in this whole chapter of We Agnostics. Matter of fact, most theologians have said that chapter We Agnostics is the greatest spiritual chapter ever written in any book. It's the only book ever written that tells you where you can find God and who God is. No other book will tell you that. And this book was written by a drunk. It's pretty good. On page 55, it tells you that God dwells down in every man, woman, and child. That's the only place he can be found. Okay. Step two. I remember I was traveling and I went up to see my mother in West Virginia, and there was a good friend of mine that had a 7:30 meeting in the morning called the Mustard Seed Group. And I told him that one of these days when I come home, I'd be up there to visit that meeting. So I was heading towards Columbus, Ohio, and so I stopped in at that meeting. And there was eight men there that morning, and we was around in a circle in a chair. And we had the topic already talked about and everything else, and we was talking about it, and everybody did a pretty good job until we got over this one little guy sitting over here, and he introduced himself as being Ted. And he said, "I'm very, very scared." He said, "This Thursday I got to go in the hospital for a bypass operation." Now this is over 20 years ago, and bypasses wasn't real simple at that time. They had a lot of difficulty with them. And he said, he started giving all the reasons why he was scared, and how old he was, and he had to take off work. His wife was scary and everything else. He went through this whole fearful presentation. And all of a sudden, one of the guys sitting about two away from him was a mechanic at a Ford garage, because he had on that Ford uniform. And he looked over and he said, "Ted, what time Thursday are you going to be operated on?" He said, "Well, they just told me," he said, "somewhere around 8 o'clock, 8 a.m. And this Ford mechanic looked over and said the most profound thing I've ever heard. He said, "Ted, at 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to ask the God of my understanding to go over and be with you and help you get through that operation." I've never heard anybody ever talk about that, about a God that's personal to them. But it certainly convinced me that there was a God that was personal to me. I think that statement in the big book, that we can choose our own conception of God, makes a lot of alcoholics very comfortable. And it gives us the opportunity that we can accept something like that. That we don't have to go to the God of the church and try to find our God there. When you talk about step three, it says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. Next, we decided that hereafter in the drama of life that God was going to be our director. We decided that hereafter in the drama of life, God's going to be our director. That's the decision we make. Because if you read it on the wall, it said made a decision. That means it's already been made. So here's where we make it. The third step prayer just solidifies that a little bit more. So each of us has to make a decision. When I was in college back there with the Sadie Hawkins day, I had two fraternity brothers I ran around with. And on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday of every week, we had a free time from 10 to 11, all 3 days. And one of the things that we liked to do was drive over to town to Kresge's, because they had this automatic donut machine. And it would put the dough in, it would come out in a circle and in this grease and go around and flip over, and then it would get kicked out, and this girl put icing on it, and powdered sugar and everything. And so we could go over there for 10 cents, get us a cup of coffee and two donuts. And we would sit down and we'd talk about these donuts. And we'd sit there one day and you said, "You know what we ought to do? We ought to go in business and start us a donut shop and make every kind of donut there is. Jelly-filled, chocolate, custard-filled, every kind of donut. We ought to put coffee, hot chocolate, orange juice, all the drinks in we possibly can. We ought to put these shops in." Well, we finished our coffee and donuts. We got in our car and we went back to school. 2 years later, Mr. Donut came to town. You see, we made a decision, and we didn't do a damn thing about it. So nothing's going to happen. So you can make the third step decision instead of you. If you don't take the action of the rest of the steps, you're not going to get anywhere. So I had to, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. And then this is what I think. This is the way I put it. I had to look at my resentments, my fear, and my sexual conduct, and I had to list these things. And what I thought I was doing for all these years that I've been drinking, I collected a lot of garbage. And I just considered myself just a walking garbage can. And what I had to do with this garbage can is just dump everything out of it. And I had to clean that garbage can up real good. And you know, and I had to put it back in. Then I had to look down at this stuff I had kicked out. You know, where some things, like my parents, well, I had to pick them up, clean them up, and make amends to them, and put them back in my life. My kids are down there. Some good friends are down there. Some good employers are down there. That's what I had to do to them. Clean them up, make amends to them, and put them back in my life. Everything that's left over, I had to discard and get rid of it. And that's what I had to do. And I had to put it on paper so I could look at it. And that's exactly what I had to do. You know, when it comes to the sex conduct, we had this girl named Mary. And she was going to a lot of meetings and everything, but she was acting out sexually. And her sponsor was getting kind of tired of it. And so one night she got her in a corner and she said, "Now, Mary, I want you to go home and I want you to read everything there is on page 69 about sex, and I want you to start putting it in your life." And Mary said, "Okay." So Mary was a little bit dyslexic, and by the time she got home, she pulled this book down, and she turned to page 96. And this is what it says. "Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself." Anyway, so we have a lot of fun with the big books. And I love to do that just to get people laughing again. Step 5. Admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of my wrongs. I had to admit these things to God, and Slick said I had to find a place where I was in God's territory, and I could do that, and I admitted all those things on that 4-step to him. I called him up and told him I did it, and he said, "Well, come on over." And when I went over, he told me I had to go back to that same place and admit him to myself. And I said, "Well, I just did that." He said, no, you didn't do that. He said, "This time I want you to read them out loud so you know what you've done." And I did that. And then after I did that, I called him. He said, "Well, call Clarence, and I want you to go up to Clarence." That was his sponsor. "And I want you to tell Clarence everything you did." And I did that. And I spent about 3.5 hours with Clarence. And he was a very nice man. And he listed all the character defects that he heard. And I was able to get rid of, do my 5th step. And I was real, real happy about that, and I really felt good. And it reminds me that my son Andrew is a Little League baseball manager. And my grandson played in the Little League, and my granddaughter played softball, but my son was pretty good with these 15 kids, and he practiced them all the time. They played a lot of games and everything else, and I kept telling him I was going to come up and watch him play whenever I could find time that my wife could get up, get off work, and we could go. And so he called me one day. He said, "Dad, when are you coming up?" And I said, "I don't know. Nancy and I can't get off to do it." And he said, "Well," he said, "I wish you would, because one of my fathers up here has been drinking an awful lot, and he just got fired from his job. He and his wife were separated. He's not living at home, and he's coming by the games, and he just reeks of alcohol and everything else." And the other day I went over to him and I said, "You know, my father's in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's coming up here pretty soon." He said, "Would you talk to him?" And the man looked at my son and said, "Yes, I would." And so my son told me that. So I told Nancy, "Come on, we got to go." And so that Friday, we left and went up to Belvedere, South Carolina. And as soon as we got there and got settled down a little bit, I asked my son what that man's phone number was. And he gave it to me, and so I called, and it rang, and it rang, and it rang, and rang. And so I waited around a little bit longer, and I tried again. It just rang, and rang, and rang, and rang. I tried 3 times that night, and it just rang, and rang, and rang. So we said, all right. And spent the time talking, went to bed and got up the next morning. About 9 o'clock, I called the number again. I just rang and rang and rang. Well, we had to go to the ball game, see my granddaughter play early morning, then in the afternoon see my grandson play. So after we got home, I called the man again on the telephone, and it just rang and rang and rang and rang. I tried 4 more times on Saturday night to do that, and there was never any answer to the phone. And so on Sunday, we got up, and we was going back home, and I tried 1 more time, and the phone didn't answer. So we went on home, and I just said, well, it's too bad. Well, about 2 weeks passed, and the phone rang one evening, and my son was on the phone. He was talking a little bit, and he said, Dad, he said, I've got some bad news for you. He said, that man I wanted you to see and talk to committed suicide. I don't know in this book where it tells you to call somebody up on the telephone. That's one of the worst burdens I think anybody has to carry around, because I didn't do what I was taught to do. I don't know whether I could have helped the man or not, but I didn't even give it a try. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Slick asked me if I was ready, entirely ready, and I said, well, I don't know what you mean by entirely ready. He said, well, do you know why you have these character defects? And I said, well, Clarence and I talked about a few of them. He said, well, do you know where they came from? And I said, no, I don't think so, not really. He said, well, why don't you go home and put some thought to it, because if you know where these character defects come from, then you can get rid of them easier. And I said, okay. So I went home, and I really put some thought into each one of my character defects I had, and I came up with some pretty good responses. So I went over to Slick's house, and when we go back in, and we're talking about them and everything else, and he said, well, you've done a pretty good job. He said, do you think God's going to remove all these defects of character? There's another one of those questions you've got to be careful how you're going to answer. And I kind of looked at him, and I wanted to say, well, yes. And I said, I don't know, Slick. And he said, no. Hell, God's not going to do for you what you can do for yourself. He said, you spent 50 years developing all these character defects, and you think God's going to take away like that? No way. He said, but I'll tell you what, Hillbilly. He said, if you will go in life, and if these character defects come up, if you will work on them at that time, they'll be taken away. And you know what? That's exactly the truth, and that's exactly the way they happen. They weren't taken away like that. But when they came up in my life, I caught myself, and I did something about them right then and there. And they're pretty much all gone. Today, those character defects sometimes are little God bumps, and I'll tell you why. I went to work one day, and I had something on my mind. I couldn't get it out of my mind, just disturbing to me, and I didn't know what it was. And what I normally do, I go through my phone book and see if there's somebody I'm supposed to call. And I go down the names like this, and I finally got over to about halfway through my phone book, and my finger came down and stopped on this name. And I just kept looking at it and looking at it, and I looked at the phone number. It's a long-distance call. So I just said, oh, I just picked up the phone, and I dialed that number. And for some reason, I let it ring and ring. My normal thing is if it rings 6 times, nobody answers, I hang up. I must have let this ring 25 to 28 to 30 times. And finally, somebody answered the phone by saying, hello! I said, John, is this you? Yeah, what do you want? I said, this is Diz. I said, is everything all right? He said, yeah. He said, what do you want? I said, well, I don't know. I just thought maybe there's something going on, and I just wanted to give you a call and say hi and how are you, and just make sure you're doing okay. He had just gone through a divorce, and about 6 months before that, and I knew that. He said, yeah, everything's okay. I said, well, okay. I said, have a great day. And I hung up the phone, and really and truly, nothing was bothering me anymore, so I went ahead and was doing my work. About 30 minutes later, the phone rang, and the secretary told me, he said, Diz, it's for you. I said, okay, and I got on the phone and picked it up. And, hey, Diz, this is John. I said, John. I said, I just talked with you. How you doing? He said, Diz, I wasn't doing too good at all. He said, I just had a fight with one of my daughters, tried to help her out with some school clothes and things. She went down and she charged over $2,000 worth of clothes on my charge account. And he just had all these things that went wrong. And he said, you know, my wife and I aren't speaking anymore at all. And he said, matter of fact is, he said, when you called, I had a 12-gauge shotgun in my mouth ready to pull the trigger. And I said, John, that's the foolish way to do anything about any situation. There's always a way that you can solve any problem that you have. And I said, you don't have to do that anymore. John finally got the picture, and he was in the program for a long time. He did rather well. And one of the things that he always did whenever he'd go back to West Virginia, he always went over to my mom and dad's house and spent about 2.5 hours with them, just talking to them. I knew why he was there. It's one of those God bumps. Made a list of people that I'd harm and became willing to make amends to them all. I made that list when I made my fourth step, so it wasn't too hard to do. So all I had to do is, Slick said, to put them in four columns. Put in the columns that you could get to here, 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 and here. And said, when you do them, bring them to me. And so I went home and I did that, put them right in the columns. And I said, okay, I got them done. I brought them over to him. He looked at me, tore it up. Wow. I said, what'd you do that for? And he said, because you left two people off this list. I said, I left two people off. He says, yeah, you left two people off. Now go home and deck this list out good. And so I said, I can't believe it. So I went back and went over and scrutinized my whole four step and went through and got every name and I put them back on that list. You know? And I said, I didn't miss anybody. And I called him up and I said, I fainted. He said, fine, come on over. I went over to his house. And we sat down at that white porcelain table. He said, let me see your list. I showed it to him. And he took it and he tore it up again. And I just looked and I said, Slick, I don't understand. And he said, I know you don't, Hillbilly. He said, but the two people you left off that list is you and God. Unless you make amends to God, you can't make amends to anybody else. And if you can't make amends to yourself, nothing else will work. And so I had to put my name on that list. Old age is showing up on me here. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I could go out and make these amends, and so I did them all. And you know, when you make the first column, you get finished with that, the next column jumps over, you make amends to them, the next caller jumps over, and you make amends to them, etc. And pretty soon you make your amend. Well, I had moved away from North Carolina and was making my amends. I was in Florida now. And I was talking to Slick, but Slick told me to get a new sponsor. And so I got this new sponsor. And one of the things that I did was sit down and talk to him about everything, who I was and everything else. And he said, that's pretty good. I was still a traveling salesman. So as I traveled out sometimes, I'd call him and I'd say, I'm coming in on Thursday. How about meet me? And so we'd meet down at his meeting place and we'd drink a pot of coffee. And so this one Thursday I came in there and we were sitting down there talking and Tom said, well, how's your week going? I said, well, funny things happen. He said, what's that? And I said, back when I was 12 years old, and I told him about the same story I told you about taking the girl to the dance and going over in the corner. And I said, that popped in my mind. And he looks at me and says, how many times have you fought like that? I said, probably 3 or 4 times. And he said, well, if I was you, I'd do an inventory on it. I said, Tom, that's 43 years ago. He said, I don't care. He said, if something like that pops in your mind 4 times, then you better do an inventory on it. So I said, okay. So I went home and I did an inventory and I wrote all about that dance and all the harms I'd done and everything else. And so I knew a friend of mine. I went over and I talked to him about it. So I did a fifth step on it. And so I just let it drop right there. So I tell you, sponsors show up whenever you've got work to do. And so he came into my home group one night. He never comes there. He came over and he's sitting here talking. He says, hey, how you doing on your amends? And I said, well, what amends? He said, well, you did an inventory not too long ago, didn't you? And I said, yeah. He said, would you make your amends yet? I said, Tom, that's 43 years ago. This girl's married and probably got grandkids. He said, well, he said, I know guys that's got drunk for less. And I said, okay. So a couple of days later, I was home doing some paperwork, and I said, well, I better do it. I just happened to have her phone number because I have an alumni directory in. And so I called her, and I dialed that number, and it rang about the third time. And some kid picked it up on the other end of the phone, and I hung up. I said, I can't do this. This is really crazy. I said, no, if Tom told me to do it, I better do it. So the next day, I called again, and about a third ring, this time she picked up the telephone. And I said, Pat, this is Diz Titcher. And there was that kind of that pause, you know, after all those years. And she said, well, Diz, how are you? And I said, I'm doing pretty good. And we've talked about it a little bit. And I finally got around and I said, do you remember that evening years ago when I took you to that Christmas dance and went over and stood with the Stag Boys and I just treated you pretty terrible and everything else? And there was another pause. And she said, Diz, yeah. She said, you know, I thought about that not too long ago. And she said, I remember everything that happened that single night. And I said, well, I want you to know that I take full responsibility for my actions that night. And I need to let you know that I'm terribly sorry for how I acted. And she was just beautiful. She said, Diz, she said, I have forgiven you. And she said, matter of fact, I love you for calling and talking to me about it. And I just think you're a wonderful individual. Thank you very much. And I hung up the phone. Would you believe it was 2 months before I saw my sponsor? He never came to a meeting. He wasn't home when I called him or anything else, and I couldn't tell him what happened. But that's the way it goes. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admit it. That step is very important, but right in the middle of it, it gives me some information I've got to do. It says I've got to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And I think the more that I work and rework these steps, I understand them a lot more. And if I understand them more, I can effectively make them work better. And I think that's what the 10th step is. I was living in Virginia Beach for a while and going to meetings up there, and I love going to meetings in Virginia Beach, especially on Monday night. I'd go in this meeting, and I tell you, it was just perfectly set up. All the chairs were in a row. They even had a coffee table on the coffee pot. They had dollies around. They had coffee cups. It was just a beautiful place to go. The books were all out in a row. And I said, wow, this is neat. And I always had some good meetings there. And I went there about 2.5 years. And then I missed about 5 meetings in a row. And then when I finally did come back to that meeting, I walked in and I said, wow, what happened? I mean, it looked like it had a bullfight in there. Everything was disarray. The coffee pot was just bubbling over and spilling on the table and everything. And the books wasn't out, you know, the chips wasn't out. And I said, what's going on here? And finally all the people came and they just sit down like nothing ever happened. And there was this young man sitting in the front row there. And so the chairperson said, before we open the meeting, this young man would like to talk to us a while. And so he introduced himself and he said, you know, my mother was a member of this fellowship, and this is a meeting that she was in charge of, and she used to come down here every day at 5 o'clock and set it up. And she did that for over 2 years. But you know, the last probably year and a half, she suffered from cancer. And she couldn't always do what she wanted to do, but she managed to get it done. But about 2 weeks ago, it got so bad that she couldn't even walk up the stairs to her bedroom. My dad had to put a day bed in the dining room where she could sleep on and rest. And he said, a couple of nights ago, my dad came in to get her ready for bed, and she looked up at him, and she said, would you do me a favor? And he said, yes, anything. And he said, would you put me a double shot of whiskey and a cigarette and a lighter on my night table? And he said, yes, I will. And so he put a double shot of whiskey and a cigarette and a lighter on her night table there, and he kissed her on it and went up to bed. The next morning he gets up and he comes down and he opens the house up, opens the blinds up, gets the paper off the porch and he looks in, nothing, she's not awake yet, so he reads the paper and then it's finally getting late and he looks up and so he walks into the room and he turns the light on. When he looks, she's not moving. And when he goes over, he notices that he grabs her by the arm and it's cold. And sometime during the night she had died of her cancer. But when he looked over on the table, that double shot glass was still there. And so was a cigarette lighter. And I often wondered, what was the moral of that story that that kid had to tell me? And we were talking about today in the meeting we had at 4 o'clock. The lady wanted to exercise her right of choice even though she was dying. Every day when we get up in the morning, we got a choice. I can ask God to enter my life and give me guidance as I go through the day. Or I can sit and drink coffee and look out the window and just do whatever I want to and expect everything to happen automatically. And for us, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 11 is our discipline step. It says that in there. Bill Wilson tells us what we got to do when we get up in the morning. It gives us some questions there that we got to answer. It tells us what we do as we go through the day. It tells us that even when we get agitated, we got to pause. And it tells us what we got to do at night. He tells us that we got to discipline ourselves. And so step 11 is the discipline step. There's another young man that was from the Midwest. He'd gone joined AA out there and was in AA a couple of years, and he had a salesman job and he was doing real well. He was going to a lot of meetings. He was married and had two young kids, and the vice president called him in one day and said, "Gee, you're doing so daggone good. We'd like to transfer you to Atlanta and have you develop that territory over there for us." And he said he'd be tickled to death too. And so he went home and told his wife he got a promotion. They were going to go to Atlanta. And so they moved to Atlanta, and the first thing he did, went to a meeting, got established in AA there. And people got to know him real well. His kids went to school, his wife got established, and everything was going pink. He was doing that for about 3 years up there. And one Saturday morning, his wife got up to go to the store, and she driving to the store, and one of these cement trucks ran a red light and hit her head on and killed her. And the man was devastated. He went to his home group, and he told them what had happened. And he's asked if anybody would help serve as pallbearers in order to get him through this situation. And six of the guys volunteered and said they would. And he said he was going to have the services at a local church, but he was going to take her back to the Midwest and bury her back in the hometown where she was from. And so after the services, of course, the six pallbearers pick up the casket and take it to the hearse. And they drive the hearse to the railroad station, the train comes in, the six pallbearers get the casket and take it up and put it on one of the cars. And, of course, the man thanked him and everything. And he said it was going to take 2 days for the train to get to the Midwest, and he got on the train with his two boys and he took off. And when the train arrived in that Midwest town, the man got off and got ready to go back to the car where the casket was. And standing on the platform was those six pallbearers. Two of those men were retired. Two of them were unemployed and had to borrow money in order to get things and get there and get done. And two of the men were employed and had to take off work to do that. But I think that's AA, and that's the way we ought to care for one another. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all affairs. I think our 12th step is a crowning glory of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been around longer than any other steps. When you read this book, you find out that it was Roland Hazard that made a 12th step call on Ebbie Thacker. Ebbie Thacker made a 12th step call on Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson made a 12th step call on Dr. Bob. And Dr. Bob and Bill made a 12th step call on Bill Dodson. That's the crowning glory of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to end my talk with my football story. It may not be a very good story, but I like the way I tell it. Alcoholics Anonymous is going to have a football team, and you're going to be the quarterback. We're going to give you a couple ends named patience and tolerance. We're going to give you a couple tackles named honesty and humility, and they can block anybody. We're going to give you a couple guards named unselfishness and gratitude. The center is going to be willingness, and we suggest you use willingness on every play. The running backs are belief and faith. You can hand the ball off to either one of them. Your wide receiver is going to be courage, and you can throw to him if you want to. God's going to be the only official. The ground rules are going to be the 12 steps. The football is your eternal soul, and the goalposts are the gates to heaven. Now get out there and play ball. Thank you very much.
We had something up here.
You got a glass of water.
A glass of water, that's probably enough.